Yes, it's the truth about markets for New Zealand. I'm Stacey Herbert with Max Kaiser.
Yo, it's RDU, Christchurch.
I think most people know that.
Yeah, most people. Some don't, though, you know. They're still counting up all their profits they're making trading Australian dollars and Kiwi dollars and Canadian dollars like we've been saying on this show for three or four months.
That's right. Plus, I forgot. Yeah, many people do listen online. It's not just Christchurch, New Zealand that listens to the show. It's people from all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And they're all making money on these, what they call the resource-based currencies. And meanwhile, the resourceless-based currency, the U.S. dollar, is getting hammered. Hammered!
Well, that's right. You know, as we've been saying that for, we've been talking about currencies quite a lot since our show began, because New Zealand is, of course, one of these countries where the yen carry trade was coming, and now we talked in the last few weeks about the dollar carry trade emerging.
Yeah, tell the people.
No, we've already told the people. We've been talking about that for the last 3 or 4 weeks, Max. Right. If you were here, you would have heard.
Where was I?
I don't know. You were jumping the shark somewhere, man.
Jumping the shark.
But now there's another currency which is receiving a lot of the carry trade, perhaps, is the gold.
Right.
And, you know, there used to be a gold carry trade.
Yeah.
Because governments would lend it to certain select group of bankers at 0%, essentially.
Right.
And these bankers would then sell the gold and invest it in, like, something that was paying high interest, or invest it in the tech stock bubble. During the tech boom, that I think it was the gold carry trade was a pretty big thing.
Yeah. That's right. That's how they kept the price of gold down during the whole period over the past 25 years. It never really, the price never moved up in accordance with the incipient inflation.
Well, yes, because the carry trade, it drives the value of whatever currency is being carried. It drives that down because everybody's selling it, right? By they borrow it and sell it.
That's right. That's right.
And then they buy another currency, usually, or another investment, another asset class.
Yeah, if gold were allowed to trade freely and just reflect the trends in inflation over the past 25 years, it would be $2,500 today. But because it's been used, as you point out, as source of funds to invest in higher yielding currencies, there's been this artificial selling pressure for 25 years, orchestrated by the same folks we know and love down there, Wall Street, City of London, etc. And as a result, the price has been artificially suppressed for 20, 25 years. Now, with the dollar becoming the main funding currency, the main source of funds, the main way that speculators are freeing up cash to go buy higher yielding currencies in New Zealand or Australia, gold is allowed now to trade more freely. It's also a beneficiary because people are selling the dollar short and buying gold. And so gold is breaking out of its slumber. And to me, it looks a lot like the early 1980s when the Dow Jones was hovering around 1,000. On the Dow Jones index, it had been hovering there for years and years, couldn't really get through 1,000 convincingly. Once it did, it popped up to 3,600. Then you had a massive pullback, crash of 87. Then you had a move to 14,000.
Well, you could have done the play the players, right? I mean, that's a common notion on Wall Street, right? You play the players. You don't necessarily look at the fundamentals. You look at who what the big players are doing.
John Nash's game theory?
Yeah. So I'm saying, like, Barrick Gold.
Yeah.
Just before this giant move up, they announced that they're going to get rid of their gold hedge book. They're one of the most famous gold hedge books in the world. So for the last 20 years, they've been essentially shorting the price of gold, even though they're a gold producer.
Yeah.
Now, this has been costing them billions every year for the last few years as the price is rising and rising and rising. But they also admitted in court a few years ago that they were helping suppress the price of gold for the government. So presumably they're very well connected with government. And perhaps, I think, their move to close their hedge book was a way to signal that they had private conversations with Tim Geithner, who is the head of the U.S. Treasury, who also oversees Fort Knox. But perhaps he was given in a private conversation some information that they're going to stop trying to control the price of gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, Barrick is a very interesting story, as you point out. They've been involved in gold suppression for years, even though they themselves are a gold mining company. And that's been one of the risks in investing in the whole gold mining sector, is that the gold management is not to be trusted in many cases. And so when these exchange-traded funds became available, like GLD on the New York Stock Exchange, it gave people a way to conveniently own gold as a pure play. People started to do so, and they ignored the gold mining stocks completely, because up until then, the only way to own physical gold, really, was to actually buy the stuff and store it in the bank, and it was somewhat inconvenient. But with GLD and these other exchange-traded funds, not that they're perfect, because they have their own problems, but they did give many people, and do continue to give many people, a way to own the bullion in itself and not have the vagaries of gold mining management hanging over the equation. And I think this has contributed to the popularity of gold, and it makes the gold suppression schemes harder to do. And then, of course, Stacy, you've got the emergence of the Beijing put, which we talked about a little bit last week. And, you know, again, you got to make the analog to the comparison to the 1987s.
Explain what the Beijing put is.
Yeah. How much time before break we got?
We've got about 3.5 minutes.
All right. So, in other words, anytime the price of gold drops down a bit, China is a buyer. So,
they announced at the G7 finance meeting, I believe, to Ambrose Evans Pritchard in the Telegraph, a senior advisor to the Chinese government, said that it confessed that yes, they are buying gold. They want to buy more gold. He said, however, the problem is that every time we buy gold, it goes up in price. So we do buy on any pullback.
Yeah. So anytime it drops, they're a buyer, and they're a huge buyer. So, and therefore, other people who are buying gold, they have a huge partner in this endeavor in the Chinese government. Now, the reason they call it a put is because if you buy a stock or you buy a commodity and you want to insure against any losses, you can buy a put option, which gives you the right to sell at that price during the life of the put. So you've, in fact, guaranteed your price. So anyway, it gets back, as I said, to 1987, 1980s, when Greenspan, during his tenure as Fed chairman, anytime the stock market was down, he would simply come in there with U.S. federal money and buy stocks openly in the open market, or cut interest rates to fuel the market with more cheap credit. And that became known as the Greenspan put. And now we're seeing that over on the commodity side of the equation at gold bullion. And, you know, people are starting to wake up to the fact that gold offers something that you're not going to find in other currencies, except for the natural resource type currencies in Asia and Kiwi, Australia, and New Zealand. And you know, Canada was interesting because Canada reported some pretty good employment numbers.
Yeah, their employment was up. Their economy is growing. It's a pretty high number. I don't have that off the top of my head now, but it was like 3 or 4%. Employment numbers were up. They had created something like 30,000 jobs.
Yeah. And so, again, they're talking about possibly raising their interest rates. Australia raised their interest rate because they are saying, look, the economy is growing and we need to fight, you know, become inflation fighters. And we're moving from deflation fighters to inflation fighters. We're going to raise interest rates. Now, in the U.S., they don't have that luxury, because if they start to raise interest rates now, they are going to wipe out another few million homeowners who are on these adjustable rate mortgages, and it would just cause another huge banking problem. So the U.S. is in a very tight spot. They can't raise rates. And they have to just watch as their dollar becomes the whipping boy of the global currency arbitrageurs and the carry traders.
Okay, we'll be right back after this music break, and I want to talk about the Australia raising their rates. Be right back. Max, before we went to that music break, you mentioned that Australia had raised their interest rates by 25 basis points.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Steve Keen, the Australian economist, wrote about this.
Well, yeah, what did he say?
And he thinks this is a very big mistake.
Right.
Because in their statement, the Reserve Bank of Australia said that that they're now fighting inflation.
That's right.
Steve Keen reckons deflation has not yet happened in Australia. House prices haven't collapsed. He reckons they will collapse. The debt levels are enormous, and they're far bigger than they were before the Great Depression, and they're bigger before the last housing crash.
Right.
They're, like, far greater. So the fact that, you know, they think they're fighting inflation, he reckons, is a big mistake.
Right. Well, now, the fact is that economics and markets rarely are in sync.
Okay, what does that mean?
That markets behave according to their own inner logic. Some might call that behavioral economics, which is a popular new trend in economics around the world. It doesn't mean that, you know, markets don't hew toward the underlying economic assumptions that you would think that would apply to markets. Obvious examples would be the dot-com bubble of the mid to late 90s, when you had companies with no earnings whatsoever trading for many hundreds of billions of dollars on the exchange based on really not even having any business plans. So markets were trading completely divorced from any underlying sound economic assumptions. So getting back to Steve Keen, Australia and raising interest rates, if in fact there is a perception out there that inflation is happening, that perception alone can drive inflation, which means that, for example, let's take gold, for example. If the price of gold, which Australia is really tied to in a pretty significant way, if the price of gold replaced the housing bubble, and which replaced the dot-com bubble, which replaced the previous bubble before the dot-com bubble, the NASDAQ bubble, before the NASDAQ bubble, I forget what the bubble, but anyway, if gold replaced the housing bubble.
It was emerging economy bubble. It was Russia, South Korea.
Yeah.
Remember the Asian financial crisis? I'm sure everybody in New Zealand remembers the Asian financial crisis.
Exactly. So if gold became the new Uber bubble and irrationally traded, or rationally, depending on who you talk to $5,000 or $6,000 an ounce, I mean, that would be inflationary for the Australian economy. Now, you know, Steve Keen would say there's no way that gold should be trading at that level. It's completely irrational, and that's correct. But markets do not always correspond to irrational underlying economic assumptions. So, you know, it depends. My feeling since buying gold myself for the past 5 years, and my average cost is about $400 an ounce, is that the gold offers, it was in a bear market for about 16 years. And just thinking as a contrarian, you got to go with the thing that's the least probable as being, you know, what did Jesus say? The last will be first. You know, it's just like a biblical axiom of truth. Typically, the group that's the laggard and the worst becomes the leader. And gold has been in the doghouse for so many years up until recently that it just made sense to me that as a contrarian, that this had all the potential to become a huge favorite of the speculative hedge fund community, especially if they can borrow dollars now at virtually nothing. And so they have free dollars, and gold is priced in dollars. So it's a double whammy. You can drive the dollar down and buy gold at the same time. You're getting incredible leverage on that trade. And so, you know, they could let the dogs out on this one, and the gold speculators going to, all the gold in the world, if you add it all up, it's still less than $4 trillion value for the 150,000 tons of gold that's above ground. And that's versus, 700 trillion in bogus derivative contracts?
Well, the other thing, however, is, I mean, there is, yes, that global speculative class, and most Westerners are speculators now as a career choice. Or a way of living, or economic choices. But there is the other matter, which has now been that gold is acting as a reserve currency. Because how many times in the last year have you heard all sorts of leaders of nations, leaders of the heads of the UN, the heads of the IMF, Dmitry Medvedev, the Chinese leaders, everybody's been warning that the dollars they don't think is any longer a legitimate reserve currency. And now all eyes have been on the U.S. for the last year, wondering if and when Bernanke would start monetizing the debt. Now, he said he wasn't going to do this. He promised foreign creditors that he would not monetize the U.S. debt. But Zero Hedge, in the last week, was the first to discover in Treasury bond and agency bond auctions that, in fact, this past week, the Fed started monetizing.
Mm.
Now, you're better at the whole bond matrix, so you're going to have to research this, and we'll come back with more information on this next week. But it looked like within 30 minutes of issuing some Fannie Mae bonds, the Fed bought them from whatever bank had bought the Fannie Mae bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So this also could have something to do with the dollar falling so much in the last week and gold rising. It could have been with foreign buyers, the Chinese and the Japanese, who are basically propping up the dollar. If they saw this, then they would start to worry about their own U.S. dollar holdings.
Yeah, well, they're worried. There's no doubt about that. They've been definitely worried.
Yeah, but they've been worried, but now they have reason to worry. They saw the thing they were concerned about. The thing they were worried about has happened.
Yeah, and so the pieces of the puzzle are falling in place. And, you know, I remember over the years, you know, going back 25 years since I've been, you know, watching these markets, that in the case of the dollar, at some point, they usually stage an incredible intervention. You know, Asia, Japan, and other countries would get together, and they would stage an intervention of selling yen or selling euros to force a dollar move up that would kill the shorts and wipe out the shorts and give the dollar some breathing room. And I've been waiting now for 6 months to see when there's going to be this orchestrated, coordinated intervention in the markets to give the dollar some breathing room, but it's not coming. And at the same time, the rhetoric is getting sharper and sharper from China and other countries that are now, according to Robert Fisk, they're saying now that the China and Russia and these countries, oil exporters, want to start trading oil in something other than the U.S. dollar, and that this is on the table and being discussed openly at these G7, G20, G4, G2 meetings. So maybe the cavalry is not going to come to save the dollar.
Well, however, Max, maybe it seems classic. Like all these stories, all these hugely negative dollar stories in the last week, including Robert Fisk's The Demise of the Dollar, if that didn't cause everybody to stampede into shorting the dollar, like the more you have in there, the more frenzy of shorting the dollar, the greater the chance of a massive short squeeze.
Yeah, getting back to my story about observing government intervention in the currency markets, they have in the past waited for opportune moments to look for a capitulation and other signs that their risk reward is attractive to come in there and wipe out the shorts. But you know, I mean, if the short interest in the dollar is very high, the survey of economists out there who think that the dollar can rally is incredibly low, less than 3%, which is incredibly low, statistically speaking. And if in fact, you again, using the 1980s stock market as an analogy, if in fact you do see a coordinated intervention, yeah, the dollar could rally massively for a month, but then it goes back to its primary bear trend. And it's very, very volatile, and this is going to be extremely nerve-wracking for anybody who's trying to be in these markets and trying to trade these markets or trying to stay out of the way of the volatility. It's going to be I think, dramatic. In the next couple of years, I think that people will start to refer to World War III as the currency war. And they're going to start to see the dollar and the ruble and gold and yen and Chinese currency trading 10, 20% volatility in over the course of a week or a month, and refer to that as the currency wars, because this is the first time in history that you have the ability to wage a currency war. You've got the computer power, you've got the access to the central banking system, unlimited credit, and you've got everything in place to fight currency wars, which I think will be the hallmark of World War III. You know, the wars are always, people are always looking backwards to the last war to think about how they're going to fight the current war. And those people generally don't understand that as technology advances, and in this case, it's information technology and trading technology and market making technology, as it has advanced over the past 25 years, we're now set up to do this currency war environment.
Okay. So we're going to come back with that after this music break. So, Max, before the music break, you were talking about currency wars as World War III.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
so you reckon what we're going to see huge volatility over the next few years, and that's. That's the battlefield. Those are the bombs exploding. Those are the weapons you see in action. The shock and awe, as it were.
Yeah, huge shock waves of massive buys and sells causing cascading price movements up and down these various markets. Gold will just continue to be seen as the only sound currency in the world. It's just going to continue to march higher. And it'll just continue to trade up. And the people with the most gold are going to be in the best position. But to aggregate this gold, to manage your gold, you're going to need to fight in the virtual currency wars using all kinds of trading bombs. So in other words, trading bombs are different than explosive dynamite-type nitroglycerin bombs. A trading bomb would be, for example, if you know that a certain country has a huge sell stop order in at a currency at a certain price, then your trading bomb would be set off to go off in the markets to drive the price down to touch their stop loss order in, which would drive them to automatically buy their computers to start selling. So that would be an example of a trading bomb. You see it happening in the hedge fund industry all the time. This happened during Amerith. You know, when Amerith hedge fund, with the energy industry hedge fund, blew up, it's because their competitor knew where they had their sell stops at what price. So they did a coordinated selling campaign in the markets to trigger the sell stop of Amerith, which then blew themselves up. So that's an example of a trading bomb. You see it also over there at PIMCO. They use this technique often to pick off their competitors. And it's a matter of being able to orchestrate your trading algorithms in a way that are more aggressive and more predatory than your competitors' algorithms. And so this whole race toward conventional weapons and bombs is going to be foolish, because all of the action is going to be happening on the trading floors around the world during this World War III of currency wars using trading bombs and other techniques.
You know, speaking of bombs, we were watching, there's a pretty good series called The Universe, and I forget which U.S. network has made it, but
you can History Channel.
The History Channel. So you can get it on Google it. You'll find it online. Anyway, and speaking of Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prizes in the last week for, for their they allege that he wants to end nuclear proliferation. Mm. Well, in the latest episode of The Universe, they have space wars, like what the future of space wars is going to look like. But they, in relation to Earth, basically simple physics, the most fundamental laws of physics, are now like going to be able to create weapons far greater than any nuclear weapon. And that is just basically getting a very heavy bomb, a missile, but it's just a piece of steel, a piece of titanium, and dropping it from space onto the Earth. Mm-hmm. And it would create something far bigger than a nuclear weapon.
Right. So the weapon in that case is gravity.
The weapon is gravity. and right. speed and weight.
They drop a telephone pole-sized hunk of titanium rod
yep.
from outer space, and it hits Earth with the power of 10,000 Hiroshimas.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. And this is these sort of weapons are being developed right now. So, but the U.S. can say, we're for peace. We're getting rid of nuclear weapons. But they don't tell you they're actually creating these, like, gargantuan sort of non-nuclear weapons that it's just a piece of steel being thrown at you.
That would cause a serious dent. Yeah, well, that show a few weeks ago had that other interesting idea about the people who were space diving from space platforms so that... you know, skydiving, you jump out of a plane at, I don't know, 10,000 feet or 15,000 feet.
Yeah.
Now, space diving is you set your space diving platform at 150 miles above Earth in just outside of the blue atmosphere. And you have that space. And you can dive off this platform and you space dive to planet Earth. It takes 10 minutes to space dive to planet Earth, and you wear a special diving suit to withstand the heat, tremendous heat generated as you are traveling through the Earth's atmosphere. But apparently this recreational space diving opportunity will be available sometime in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, and you reach a terminal velocity, don't you? You go like super fast, hundreds and hundreds of miles an hour.
Yeah, if you think about it, if you combine that story with the story we just talked about a minute ago, you could have suicide space bombers who would jump off platforms and fail to deploy their parachutes and hit tall buildings.
Yeah, but I think actually the problem is that the Earth's atmosphere does slow you down so much. So these missile bomb things, whatever the U.S. is creating... not only would it be projected from some sort of rocket, but also it would have some, they're building it to resist the friction caused by the atmosphere.
Well, they're very heavy, you know, the rod from God, as it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
It's made of titanium and it's the size of a telephone pole. It would be very, very, very heavy, whereas the human body would not be as heavy. So to that extent, it couldn't cause as much damage, but I wouldn't want to get hit by one.
I don't think you would know if you got hit by one.
Yeah, that doesn't make it any better. I still wouldn't like it. Wouldn't hit by one of these ones.
Anyway, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week, the same time, same place.
Bye, y'all!